Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema on Noon Forum. On today's program, we'll hear a panel discussion which followed a screening of the 2012 documentary film The Waiting Room, directed by Peter Nix. The members of the panel will include M.J. Egan, staff nurse at the University of Nebraska Medical Center, William Gossman, associate professor of emergency medicine at the Creighton University School of Medicine, Rosanna Morris, Senior Vice President for Patient Care Services and Chief Nursing Officer at the University of Nebraska Medical Center, and Robert Muleman, Chairman of the UNMC Department of Emergency Medicine. The moderator will be Richard O'Brien, Professor at Creighton University's Center for Health Policy and Ethics. This program, co-sponsored by the Center for Health Partnerships at Nebraska Methodist College, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, January 29, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the panelists and do not necessarily represent those of Film Streams, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. The Waiting Room, winner of several awards, including the San Francisco Film Critics Circle Award as Best Documentary Film of 2012, weaves the stories of several patients in the ER waiting room of an American inner-city public hospital, as well as the staff charged with caring for them, as they cope with the complexity and growing bureaucracy of the nation's healthcare system, destined to become more so as the dictates of Obamacare are forced into the system. Through their stories, The Waiting Room lays bare the struggle and determination of both a community and an institution coping with limited resources and no roadmap for navigating a healthcare landscape marked by economic and political dysfunction. It is a film about one hospital, its multifaceted community, and how our common vulnerability to illness binds us together. Here now to introduce the program is Kristen Mattson, Director of the Center for Health Partnerships at Nebraska Methodist College.
The Center for Health Partnerships is a division of Nebraska Methodist College, which is dedicated to promoting health equity here in the community. We do that through taking health care and health education into the community through the service of our faculty, staff, and students in programs like our Mobile Diabetes Center. We do that in trying to work to create career pathways and pathways to higher education for underserved groups with programs like our Upward Bound program, and in offering community education opportunities like the one here today when we partner with Film Streams to bring this film. We hope that through those community education opportunities, we will better understand the healthcare system here in our community, as well as understand health of our community and the barriers that members of our community face to obtaining good health. We would encourage all of you to stay for the panel discussion. It will be facilitated by Dr. Richard O'Brien, who is from the Creighton Center for Health Policy and Ethics.
Well, welcome to this discussion of this powerful movie that we've just watched. We have some very distinguished panelists here. My name is Richard O'Brien. I'm at the Center for Health Policy and Ethics at Creighton, and not an expert in any of the things you've seen, except maybe the lack of insurance. But these people are all experts, and I'm going to ask each of them to introduce themselves and just have a very quick reaction, and then we want to go to the audience for commentary and or questions. Now, I do want to say that this is being recorded so that we will ask all the audience members who participate with questions or other commentary to use a mic. We'll have people running around the auditorium with mics, and so if you really want to say something, wave your hand, and somebody with a mic will rush to you. So let me start with the panelists.
Hello. Oh, am I on? My name is Mary Jane Egan. I'm a staff nurse at the Nebraska Medical Center Emergency Room. My first reaction to the film was I thought it was very powerful, and it spoke to the challenges that we face today in society regarding healthcare, insurance coverage, and the demands of patients and care that's needed every day.
Hello, my name is Rosanna Morris. I'm Chief Nursing Officer and Senior Vice President for Patient Care at the Nebraska Medical Center. Overwhelming, even though we deal with this day in and day out, to see it on film and the extent by which healthcare needs to improve across the board is, I guess, overwhelming and inspiring. We need to do something.
Bill Gossman, I'm the Assistant Director of the Emergency Department at Creighton Medical Center. I thought the film was well done, but barely touches on the problem.
And my name is Bob Muehlman, and I'm the chair of emergency medicine at the Nebraska Medical Center. And reaction, it was really well done in a lot of ways. And I think the ER staff, and I know it wasn't about ER medicine, it was ER was the metaphor for bringing all these people together and their very unique stories. But from the ER perspective, I didn't think it showed the chaos. I mean, it sort of did, but and the other thing was we've got some nurses and techs that are saints also, but it didn't show the crabby ones. And the doctors, too. You know, I'm just saying, that's a hard job, and everybody was awfully nice in this movie.
They were on their best behavior, I could tell. It's not reality.
Dr. Osmond, you said there was something else you wanted to say.
No.
Oh, okay. Do we have we've got hands in the audience. Anybody have any questions here in the front row?
I'll go with policy. Do you recommend lobbying state senators this session to have Medicaid expansion so that we would have 58,000 Nebraskans that don't have to fit into chaos? Is that an immediate step that everyone in this room could do?
Are you suggesting that a large part of the problem is a lack of coverage, and clearly most of the people who showed up in that ER were without insurance or any other kind of coverage, and you're asking whether or not expanding Medicaid coverage would improve that?
That's exactly what I'm asking.
Comments?
Well, it's a real complicated question, because I think the straightforward answer is that'd be best for everybody to have coverage. And most people in the ER, because we see everybody regardless of coverage, it would make a lot of sense. But my only hazard is and this is a little biased because it's an inner-city county hospital. And I know Bill and myself have practiced at inner-city county hospitals, and it's a real unique animal in the sense of what you're seeing. But overall, the increased volume in ER is not just from uninsured patients, it's also from insured patients. So that's a whole different issue about ED overcrowding and insurance. But having said that, it's much better for a patient to have continuity of care if they have insurance and don't have to end up in the ER.
To tag off of Dr. Muehlman's comments, I think...
Speaking of the mic.
I believe that clearly that would help, but I think what saw and what is being highlighted in Dr. Muehlman's comments is an issue of access. I think we saw how patients were sometimes needing to wait several weeks or months to get in to see a provider, and that's an issue.
Any other comments from the panelists? Any other hands up in the audience? Here's one down here, front row.
I'm just curious, would you guys think that more community-based education about basic hygiene or pain management or first aid would help declog a lot of the people waiting in the ERs?
From just the nursing perspective at the front line, I think basic knowledge about pain control at home, fever control with pediatric patients, I think that would help improve, especially if parents know how they could possibly treat their child at home prior to taking them into the emergency room. But also education towards what services are available in the community is greatly needed as well.
And again, I think those would all be good things in their own, for its own reason. The education is always good. But ED overcrowding is not... from people that don't necessarily need to be there. It's more because there's no beds in the hospital. That's what jams it up. But having said that, I think education is good for a lot of reasons and should be encouraged. And I think, you know, in fairness, so a lot of people think a lot of people in the ER don't need to be there. The best estimates are maybe 12 to 15% of the people would qualify for really don't need to be there. And those would be things like maybe a prescription refill, but if you're visiting from Chicago and you can't get your doctor and it's the weekend and you absolutely have to have that medicine, that's about the only place to go. So 12 to 15%, it's not an issue where, you know, so many people in the ER don't need to be there because they weren't educated, but I think it would help on the edges. I think it would help.
And it's such a complex thing. Putting a lot of people on Medicaid, I think what are we up to, about 53 million now that don't have insurance, medical insurance in America, it's up from 47 million. And then there's a lot of underinsured people. And actually, I think I'm in that group because of my insurance rates have been going up. Let's see, 3 years ago, 15%, 2 years ago, 20%, and then last year, 35% it went up. And that, and so in my personal medical bills have gone up significantly because I have children, you know. And so if we put all those people on Medicaid, so goes the problem of who's going to pay those bills, because the government's not really able to pay those bills, and we end up eating the cost of that. So. I looked over the numbers from our emergency department. We just physician billing, this is all, you know, relevant stuff, billed $17 million. We collected 20% of that. Okay, so barely is enough to keep the lights on and that. And so I'm a big person of preventative health. I think it'll help, but the problem is that we have babies having babies and have a high dropout rate, not in the Omaha area, but throughout the country. And also it costs. It costs a lot, and are people willing to pay it? And so, yes, I do think education could help. It has to start out early, and it has to start with, you know, working on the preventative side of things. So maybe we don't see the diabetes. Maybe we don't get the high blood pressure causing kidney disease. And so it's a very, very complex thing. And I think if we can front end pay for things like preventative health, education, then my ER is not billing $17 million. So
I would like to point out one thing, Dr. Gossman, and that is that somebody is paying for it now. And that is largely people who have insurance, because their premiums, those costs are shifted, if you will, to those people who do pay. And since most of the payers are private insurers or employers, their premiums are higher simply because there's so many people who can't pay. Now, you mentioned some community resources. Would you like to elaborate on what some of those are in Omaha?
Especially working one-on-one with our case manager in the ER, different places like One World, they can provide as much help, but then you run into the issue where they can't take any more patients. So that's a roadblock for a lot of them. Homeless people, getting them into shelters, different shelters around town. Working in the ER, that's mainly what we have to deal with, and trying to find resources. But sometimes it can be very hard, especially when people need medications and medication refills. Different programs, Douglas County, things like that, are who we turn to.
Thank you. Any questions? Up there. Thank you.
Yes. Could any of you comment on whether you think the system could change a little to where you would maybe have two types of facilities within an emergency room, one less expensive and for those that don't need the intensity of the care that you saw with everybody in the movie?
A lot of emergency departments are like that. They'll have what are called fast tracks, and what they'll do is triage you, and if they determine you have a cold or sore throat or whatever, you'll just be transitioned to another part of the hospital, and, you know, to a fast track, and either see a physician or a advanced provider like a nurse practitioner or so, or a physician assistant, and that's done in a lot of places.
Yeah, and the busier you are, so I know you guys probably have a fast-track area. We have a fast-track area, and we have mid-levels because that's within their scope of capability. But really, it's a little harder than it might seem, and in this sense is that by the time you figure out which area they need to be in, you've sort of done that evaluation. And so a lot of patients, in my experience, sometimes the sickest people would tend to want to go to the urgent care because there's a little denial about, well, if I were really sick, I'd have to go to the ER, so I'm going to go to the urgent care because I don't think I'm sick. And for a long time when we ran an urgent care out in West Omaha, we had more, we had as many heart attacks show up there as we did downtown because they because of the denial part of it. So in a sense, I think the best we can do is have the fast track and provide a mid-level coverage, which is a little less expensive. The facility fee is, of course, the big part of the expense in the ER. But by the time you ask enough questions to figure out this truly is a minor situation, then you've sort of already done the workup. But I would say that it's a little bit dangerous, I don't know if it's dangerous, but to mix those two together too much is really is a mixed message. And I think the skill set for one is a little bit different than the skill set for the other. Here's what I think. I think if the clinic stayed open in the evenings and you could go see your doctor, I'd valet park for him.
I'm going to remember that. By the way.
I was just...
I think you've got a new job.
I was just wondering, you know, is there a better system to deal with? You know, I know the anything I've read, there's a certain group of people that are extremely high-cost patients, and I think an example of that was that man who came in who had the addiction problems and had been there like 12 times. And, you know, it seems like, because that it's extremely expensive kind of social, you know, the social net care for him, and shouldn't we be thinking about maybe developing a different system for people like him than the emergency room?
I would completely agree, and I think part of our challenge right now is identifying the resources necessary to support those patients in the community-based environment. So we have about 200 patients within our system that meet that very criteria, where they're coming in and out of the emergency department multiple times throughout the year and getting admitted a percentage of those times. And when you kind of, you know, lift up the covers and take a peek at what's going on, a lot of it is not only related to, you know, typical chronic illness, but also mental illness, substance abuse. And those are just issues that I think we as a society perhaps haven't necessarily taken the opportunity to deal with in an appropriate way. And so really, as a care provider, navigating a patient through, you know, not just a complex clinical health system, but also identifying resources to support patients from, you know, mental or substance abuse, not to mention psychosocial and economical issues that tie into all of that as well.
If I could just follow up on that a little bit, and Roseanne is on top of the numbers, because we've been looking at that very closely, and I think you're right on the mark in terms of looking at that, but I just want to put it in perspective. So depending on how you slice the frequent visitor, the 200 is the 12 times or more a year. What we're doing now is looking at the 8 times or more a year. That's 350 patients, which is only about 2% of our patients fit that category. So it's a very small subset. Again, the ER overcrowding isn't the frequent flyer is kind of the word, not meant to be derogatory, but the frequent flyers. But, boy, those people need care. I think the one that was the most was 39 visits in a year, one patient. That we saw, and so there's something that need. You're right. It's a different system because the clinic system isn't working, and the ER obviously is not curing them because they're coming back. But again, the point is that's maybe 2% of the people who use ER frequent flyers, but it's about 7% of the visits. So it's a significant and very important minority. But the solution is going to be very unique.
There's a breakdown. Sorry, there's a break. Anytime there's a breakdown in the medical system, the ER generally has to absorb it. And in this state, what I've learned, I've been here 7 years, that there aren't a lot of resources put out for psychiatric care. And so our psychiatric medicines generally don't work. There's never been any science to prove that a lot of them work. Really, what's been shown to work for psychiatric patients are to live in community group homes, be given jobs, whatever they can handle, and to have counseling handy, you know, pretty readily, okay? And as you can imagine that's pretty costly, but that's been shown to be the most effective way to help psychiatric patients, and it's non-existent. My psychiatric patients at Creighton will be in a bed from anywhere from 12 to 36 hours, okay, and I'm tying up a bed. Really nothing we're doing other than warehousing them until we can find a place for them. So that's just one area of the problem.
We have a question here in the middle.
Are there, this seemed pretty dysfunctional especially at certain times or in certain areas. Are there systems that are used either in the United States or elsewhere in the world that are higher functioning or more effective than the system we saw tonight?
Yes, most every developed country has a better system. I just spoke at the University of Wisconsin in La Crosse, and they actually were on one of the Dateline or 2020, one of those shows with their system. They have 24/7 social workers. They're able to get patients placed into nursing homes and skilled care facilities quickly. I have to put them in the hospital where they need to be or not for 3 days in order for Medicare to cover it. The alcoholic patient who comes in and is basically drunk but not hurt, needs really detox, they're able to do that. But they've set up the system, and they have a high number of insured patients, so they're able to take care of those. So, but if you look at about any industrialized country, a first world country, their system is much better. Everyone talks about, oh, you go to Canada, you don't get your operations. I've been all through Canada. I've worked with Canadian nurses, and it's just not true. They live longer. They are healthier. They don't tend to shoot each other as much, and they have more guns per person than we do. So maybe that has something to do with it. But that being said, all you need to do is go to most European countries, and you'll see that their system runs pretty well, and it goes to primary care as the gatekeeper. These family practitioners and internists, they're the key, and pediatricians.
Up here, towards on the...
Yes, I've been a nurse for 49 years, so I've seen a lot of different things. I'm 71, so you're all paying my medical bills right now. And I want you to know that I'm very concerned about what you're having to pay. Now, I've had several experiences. I broke my hand when I was on vacation. I thought, I'm not going to waste my time going to ER all day when I'm on vacation. So when I get home, I'll have an X-ray. They call me and they say, yeah, your hand's broken. Go to an ER. And I said, what? Go to an ER? It's been broke for 5 days. I'm not incurring the expense of going to ER when it's broke for 5 days. So then I call a doctor. Oh, well, then you can't see me for a week. And I said, I'm not in Afghanistan. There's 40 orthopedic doctors in here, and you can't get your hand. Finally, I did get to see a PA. But one of my points is, too, as we as consumers, I think, have to be better educated about what these costs are for people. Now, I'm 71. I'm very healthy. I'm a cancer survivor. I think I should be able to go to a PA, and I'd be quite comfortable at doing that for a checkup. And I don't see why I couldn't, rather than going to a doctor because I'm not sick. The other thing is, you're talking about the mental health industry, and I have a son that's been in the mental health system for a long time. I talked to his doctor. I said, you have him on a med that costs $600 a month, and he only makes $400 a month. I had to argue with him and argue with him, and finally I said, if you're treating Warren Buffett, you can give him a $600 a month medicine, but he's a long-term chronic patient. You can't give him. Finally got him to put him on cheaper medicines. He's doing better than he's ever done. So I think we need to, consumers continue to fight to keep some of these costs down.
You know, you're right. The problem is, and I study this stuff, the cost at university is going to be different than at Creighton, then it's going to be different at the Mayo Clinic, then it's going to be different at the University of Iowa. And I can tell you right now that You ask anyone, you know, you go in there, and if you ask someone, what's it going to be for my ER bill here? No one can answer that. I don't, because wait a minute, I gave you a Tylenol. Well, that's $47.32. And let's see, I mean, it's crazy the way the bills are. And something like that does need to be somehow standardized so that people do have an idea what it is, because it's impossible to shop. Because I would rather do that, and I do that for dental care and some things because they kind of – you have an idea. But it's so complex, and most people in the hospital, they don't know, and they can't even explain the bill to you. It's crazy.
Well, and if you have somebody really sick, there's no way you can figure out the bill. I've been through that too. But I guess I'm telling all you younger people, I'm really trying to keep my bills down way under what I pay.
We appreciate that.
Well, thank you for that. There's a question over here.
Right. I was trying to figure out how I can frame this. I'm going to try to do my best. What stood out to me in the film was the despair and the hopelessness of the poor who looked at the emergency room as a last resort. And I was wondering if someone can speak to the attitude and maybe the disposition and the beliefs that kind of result from the interaction with the healthcare system. I happen to know if there's a tendency in the poor, if you go and try to talk to a primary care physician and you can't afford it, that there's a shame and stigma that's associated with that. So you decide not to go back. And then you say that, well, I'm not going to go to the hospital at all unless it's an emergency room, because there's less shame and less stigma associated with that, and maybe, you know, the cost will be covered there. But as you said, that the primary care physician is kind of like the best, you know, road to travel. And is there a right or a wrong way that the poor should view the primary care physician, the emergency room? And, you know, what my thoughts are is do you wrestle with the economic factor with the primary care physician, and you try to get insurance, and you try to wrestle and build that into your finances, or, you know, what is the right attitude?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. It's very demoralizing on our end, and I can't tell you how many times when I say there's nothing I can really do for you, you need to follow up. Well, I can't. I don't have the insurance, or I don't have the money, and. You know, and I make phone calls and I barter, like the one guy was bartering with the neurologist. I've done that. And Creighton has started years ago a free clinic that I staff at the Sienna Francis House. I have people showing up there whenever, especially if I'm staffing it, so that I can work on getting them free medicine. And it is. It's very demoralizing. And the problem is a lot of that frustration is turned to anger. My emergency department is crazy. I've been bitten. I've had my foot broken. I've had all kinds of stuff. It can be a crazy world. And I feel the frustration of the patient, and it's difficult to not turn that into anger on my part, because I'm helpless. I'm absolutely helpless in so many instances, and it leads to a lot of burnout. And in my field, there's a lot of study on burnout among physicians and nurses, because there is, and it's classic. I remember when there was a comment made by George Bush about our healthcare system, and he said, "Well, if all else fails, go to an ER." And that's kind of the general consensus of a lot of people who don't understand this. And I'm happy to help. I really am. That's why I've chosen this. But, you know, we can't do it all. And that's kind of what it's coming down to.
You know, I think one of the good things about practicing in the emergency department is that you don't have to necessarily go there. In other words, I don't know who has insurance and who doesn't. And it's kind of the last democracy in medicine, and that it's really based on how sick you are, not how much insurance you have. So that's a kind of a luxury off our back, as opposed to if you're trying to run a practice and you have to ask all those questions. But that goes back to your issue about having more people insured, so that, you know, you don't have to have those uncomfortable conversations. But, it's amazing what people, you know, no matter how bad a day you have after working a shift in the ER, you don't feel so bad because you've seen so many people that have it worse, and it's a ongoing exchange. But my experience in the ER is a lot of people are there for that very reason, so they don't have to have those economic conversations, and it's what's best for you and trying to get that conversation going.
And I think you see that play out, you know, kind of person to person. I think we saw that on the film, even though perhaps we weren't as grouchy as we may be on any typical day. I think the reality is we can't single-handedly impact or change the things that are fundamentally broken in this system. But what we can do is try to do what's right and what's best when we've got that patient in our care. And I think regardless of whether it's a med center or a Creighton, that's what fundamentally people do, is just make that experience the best it can be in the few minutes that they've got with those individuals.
Up here, okay.
I'd like to know how the Affordable Care Act will impact your emergency departments especially as far as access to care for people, as well as, of course, getting most people being covered by insurance, but access to care.
Actually, I'll address that a little bit because that happens to be an area in which I have some expertise. The Affordable Care Act is projected to reduce the number of uninsured people in this country from the roughly 53 million down to about 25 million. So basically, it'll cut the uninsured in half so that far more people will have insurance coverage. Furthermore, it defines the very basic minimum that insurers have to cover for services, benefits. And the other thing that it does, we had a comment earlier on, and another thing it does, we had a comment earlier on about, I'd have been happy to see a PA. Well, actually, it expands educational opportunities for physician's assistants and nurse practitioners, because one of the things that we're concerned about with the Affordable Care Act is that the demand for medical services is going to increase, and we need to be sure that we have the workforce to manage it. And we already know we have a shortage of primary care physicians. It turns out not to be quite so short as some people have said, but nonetheless, it is a shortage. And with an increased demand, we have to be sure that we have adequate numbers of people, providers, for primary care services, and thus the expanded educational opportunities for PAs and nurse practitioners. And
I believe that, from my understanding of it, that it's going to be a windfall for hospitals, because instead of that 20% I talked about, reimbursement is probably going to be a lot more. Now, how long that's going to last when the government gets those bills and starts paying them, that's another thing, but I can't predict that. But early on, it's going to be the hospitals are going to do better. And my hope is that primary care providers can now, because it's hard to see people for free. You got to keep the lights on and pay your nurses. I fully understand that. And so, they're going to be able to see these people now and get some kind of reimbursement. So my hope is that more of these folks, especially with the chronic problems, will get plugged in.
Actually, with respect to cost to the government, the Affordable Care Act, the CBO is projected, will actually reduce the deficit between 2010, when the act was introduced, and 2020 by $140 billion. So that it shouldn't add costs if it works the way it's intended to work, and in fact should at least have some slight impact, and $140 billion is a slight impact, but at least it's a positive impact on the deficit. Okay, we have a question up here.
After seeing the film, and since you guys are on the front lines, what would you like to see changed in your ERs? As a user of UNMC, TNMC's ER, thank you very much. I know how great it is. So, what would you change if you could change something?
Being out there working in triage, I would have more access to clinics, like we said earlier, more access to urgent cares, especially even for employees through certain health systems. You are kind of limited on urgent cares in some areas, and probably more knowledge as to how they can receive care outside of the ER through those clinics and other resources like urgent cares?
Well, my wish list would be that if a patient needed to be admitted, there'd be a bed, like, right now. Yeah, because if that happens, right now we see about 51,000 patients in our ER, and most of the time we hum pretty well. It's if we get 20 check-in per hour, that's kind of a surge. It's hard to handle. Then beds upstairs don't matter, but when you're seeing about 140, 150 a day, as long as we have beds upstairs, then, you know, we're pretty well oiled for that kind of volume. But if we start getting jammed up, then it doesn't matter. So if we had perfect throughput and admission, we could probably see 60,000 in our current space if it ever got to that point. So to me, it doesn't matter so much what comes in the front door as long as I've got a back door. Yeah, so that'd be on my wish list is unlimited beds.
Well,
Rosanna.
Sometimes we know that the back door is not there because we have had occasions in Omaha when I think both of our institutions have actually had to close their ER because there was nothing to do with more patients.
You're right about that, and that you know, we have not exhausted all the different strategies that others have used, and I think H1N1 taught us a lot of lessons. That's when we learned an awful lot on how to operate under disaster scenario.
Tell the people what H1N1 is.
That was the flu epidemic back in, I think, 09, maybe 09.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we were seeing up to 200 a day in the ER during that epidemic, and a lot of people were being admitted to the hospital. But, again, I think Omaha is blessed. You know, most ERs are seeing about 30,000. We're at about 50,000. And most of the time there are beds in the city. They're very rarely on diversion. But you're right to bring up that in the past, in fact, in the last year, have we been on diversion more than a day?
The average wait time in Omaha is about 40 minutes to see a provider, whereas across the country it's about 6 hours. Where I worked in Chicago, it was 10. So,
oh, okay.
But you were saying a wish list.
On my wish list, we have one case manager in our emergency department who's here tonight. She is amazing, but frankly, you know, that's just one point in care when the patient enters, and so we really need more robust case management and navigation models to help transition patients throughout all points of care.
Okay. Any other questions? Here's one over here.
Having worked in the emergency room on the night shift for about 10 years, one of the things that I didn't see is all the geriatric patients that are sent in from the nursing home to have their G-tube changed, their cath changed, this, that, and whatever, with our aging population. And I've read about some geriatric emergency rooms. Do either of your facilities have anything that you're planning for the geriatric ER population?
We don't. That's the largest group, demographic group that's over the last 10 years have been the elderly. And we basically right now absorb them, you know, and it is. It's how do I say it? It really bogs down the department because we can't get them upstairs to a bed where they need to be. And what would be really nice is if a lot of this could be handled at the nursing home itself, but they're taxed to the max already, too.
So in general, as far as the odds of you being in this group right here, being in the emergency room this year, is about 1 out of 3 of the general population. Over 65, it's 2 out of 3. So it is a big issue, but nobody's really got the critical mass to open up a geriatric ER. And I know that they're around in the country, but I'm not sure necessarily how they would be different. The real issue for me is what's the capability of that nursing home? In other words, some can be relatively ill, and you can send them home on IV antibiotics. And others can't. And there's various levels. So there's really some communication issues, I think, in terms of, you know, here's what we found, which may or may not need to be admitted depending on the capability of the nursing home. In that discussion takes a long time, and that's sort of what bogs it down. So I think that if you had a geriatric ER, you'd have some of those same issues. So in other words, the skill sets aren't that different. You wouldn't have to specialize anything. It'd be more in terms of the discussions and dispositions and where they're going to go back to, or if they need higher level of care, how can you navigate that without admitting them for 3 days and then getting them into a different level of care? So, but the short answer is no. I don't know anybody that's doing a geriatric ER in this town.
So much of this is trial and error to really figure out good solutions that are going to be long-lasting. And one of the things that we are piloting is having advanced practice nurses actually manage patients in the skilled nursing facility environment. Because what's happening is patients either coming in through the ER and or coming in through the outpatient environment, once they come into the hospital, you know, length of stay for patients is much less than it has been ever. And so patients are going back out either into the home environment or into the transitional care environment, and they're still pretty sick. And so what's happening is in the skilled facilities and or long-term care, you know, they're dealing with some issues that sometimes we've dealt with historically in the hospital. And so having resources readily available and expertise to manage patients in their own environment, you know, because typically what would happen is a patient would start to change clinically, a call would go to the physician provider, and they'd say, well, you know, I'm not there, send them to the ER. Well, rather than, you know, send them to the ER, maybe we can have someone actually physically evaluate the patient in that environment, provide some level of intervention. Obviously, there's not, they can't do everything in that environment, but we have already found a pretty significant impact on the transfers, if you will, into the emergency department. The challenge we have right now is that we're just starting and the sample size is small. But we think that we're at least figuring out maybe one potential solution that we can deploy long term.
Should I wrap this up? Okay. We're going to wrap this up now. First of all, I want to give the panelists each a moment for 30 to 40 seconds of wrap up, and then I want to thank them, and I'll thank all of you. Please.
One thing that we kind of commented on at the beginning was that a lot of the frustration from staff is not really shown in the video. Working in the ER, it can be very frustrating and hard on nurses and physicians. When you see patients and you don't have necessarily the resources that you want to provide to them, or people waiting in the waiting room who you think necessarily don't need to be there sometimes, but it can be very frustrating and taxing on a nurse. But I think if you really look back, and the video did a great job of showing each patient as an individual person, and everyone has their own story, and I think it's very important to look at that.
30 to 60 seconds, please.
30 to 60 seconds. So whether, you know, you agree with health care reform or the Affordable Care Act or all of the changes that are coming down the pike, without a doubt there's tremendous opportunity for improvement for us to really do health care delivery and health care or health prevention in a much better fashion. And I think we have to embrace that as a society.
I am thankful every day. I think I made the right choice. It's frustrating. It is very taxing, and it's hard to not bring the job home and that. But I feel blessed that I'm able to do emergency medicine. You all are going to have to, especially the youngsters here, are going to have to grapple with the changes that are going to come, and they're not going to be good. There's going to be in time rationing of healthcare. I don't know how that's going to look or what. And so I think a huge emphasis needs to be put on preventative care, and problems with diabetes, well, let's say obesity is a big one, and gun violence and all those other major social problems. You know, we're going to have to come to grips with that and find a way to keep ourselves healthy.
Yeah, I don't, 30 to 60 seconds, I don't have a lot, I can't say very much profound about that, but I do want to share what my favorite part about the movie, though, from an ER doc perspective. And I know they weren't real technical about, you know, they showed the gunshot wound and the blood and all that kind of stuff, but what do you think was the most skillful thing that doctor did during the movie? And
I'm not going to wait for the answer.
You tell us.
I'm going to tell you, and it's what Dr. Gossman mentioned, is when the doctor negotiated that follow-up with the neurologist. And I think it's a good example of what nurses do every day and what the doctors in the ER every day is we're trying to advocate for the patient. And I think that showed it best of anything that went on in the movie. And it's just from the provider perspective, that was so skillful. And that's the thing we tell our residents, you know, you could – a lot of those procedures you could train anybody to do, but to train somebody to do that is to advocate for your patient in that manner was, I about stood up and started clapping.
We wish you had.
We are here for you. That's
well, I want to thank all of the panelists for their participation, their attention, and their insights based on experiences. I want to thank all of you in the audience. For one, being here, two, being sufficiently attentive to raise some very interesting and important questions. And I'd like to thank FilmStreams, Casey, Rachel, and Kristen, wherever you are. Kristen, where are you? There you are. conceiving the idea of this and putting it on. So thank you all very much.
You've been listening to a special program from FilmStreams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema on Noon Forum. We've heard a panel discussion which followed a screening of the 2012 documentary film The Waiting Room, directed by Peter Nix. The members of the panel included M.J. Egan, staff nurse at the University of Nebraska Medical Center, William Gossman, associate professor of emergency medicine at the Creighton University School of Medicine, Rosanna Morris, Senior Vice President for Patient Care Services and Chief Nursing Officer at the University of Nebraska Medical Center, and Robert Muleman, Chairman of the UNMC Department of Emergency Medicine. The moderator was Richard O'Brien, Professor at Creighton University's Center for Health Policy and Ethics. This program, co-sponsored by the Center for Health Partnerships at Nebraska Methodist College, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, January 29, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Rachel Jacobson, Casey Logan, Alyssa Madden, and Jim Foyt of FilmStreams for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now this is your producer and host, Bob Coate, thanking you for listening.